going to be talking to us about something slightly different to the original title, but I think it's from the same sort of material.
Okay, thanks, Ruth. This is a new paper for me, so I will be using notes. But I'm very, very grateful to be able to speak to you today, because it's actually kind of made me put together a paper that I've been meaning to write for a number of years. A paper that's based around a set of novels written by a guy called Derek Raymond. So my paper's called "The Dust of Our Great Capital: Urban Implosion and Derek Raymond's Factory Quartet." So the paper's concerned with the morbid space created by the noir fiction author Derek Raymond in a quartet of detective novels written about an unnamed detective in the Metropolitan Police. Primarily, the paper is about urban history and London's transition from one kind of city to another. The aim here is not to construct a theory of detective fiction, one can look elsewhere for that, but to provide an analysis of how these four crime novels reveal a unique imaginary of London at a critical point in the city's history, a phase that may be seen as both an end and a beginning. Now, I begin with this quote here from the fourth book of the quartet, which was called "That Was Dora Suarez." And it says, "Presently I got out my flashlight and shone it over her, because the place where she had collapsed and died between the beds was so dark, and the old white light shade overhead, thick with dust, was wrongly placed to shed enough light on her. In the glare of the torchlight, her indifferent eyes glittered coldly past me. On these eyes, the dust of our great capital was already beginning to settle." So the woman who is murdered here, brutally murdered, she's already kind of, she's racked with AIDS before she was murdered, and the detective kind of finds her body, and he makes this comparison between, you know, her demise, but also the dust of the capital, which is settling on her open eyes. And it's about the demise of Dora, but also the demise of the city, how as they turn to dust they almost become one with each other. And this whole kind of metaphysicality is very important in these novels. So this analysis of urban history that I present today is premised upon the notion that literary virtualizations of actual space can, through the fantasies and the dreams that they disclose, be productive of new theories of urban space. And these fantasies, I argue, should be seen as part of the reality of the city. They are a component, after all, of urban consciousness, of urban subjectivity. Okay, now Derek Raymond, the author of these books, his real name, Robin Cook, was born in 1931 into a wealthy family. He grew up in London and was educated at Eton during and just after World War II. However, he hated Eton, and he said that the only person who hated it more than himself was George Orwell. Age 16, he dropped out and embarked on a very different kind of life to that which might have been expected. He drifted to Spain, travelled to America before returning to London. And during the late 1950s and early 1960s in London, he became involved in the London underworld. He ran companies for various con men. He later, when he was kind of penniless, which kind of seems strange to not born into that kind of family, but he became a minicab driver and also an abattoir assistant. And these experiences of 60s London ended up in his books that were written as Robin Cook, which include The Crust on Its Uppers from 1962 and A State of Denmark in 1970, books which detail the life of, or, you know, happenings within the London underworld of the 1960s. Mainly they're about the life of villains. Raymond escaped to France during the 70s and 80s. It was during the 1980s that he embarked on the Factory novels, which were based around the activities of an unnamed, tough-talking, cynical detective sergeant at the Met Police's Department for Unexplained Deaths. In other words, they took up murder cases where the victim was unknown. Okay, so people who society ostensibly didn't care about. The Factory was the name used by both the police and villains for the police station in Poland Street where the detective is based. And the quartet comprises He Died With His Eyes Open, 1984, which in October appeared, there was an adaptation of this on Radio 4, which very conveniently I missed, and it's no longer an iPlayer. It's always the way, isn't it? The Devil's Home on Leave, published in 1985. How the Dead Live, 1986, and I Was Dora Suarez in 1990. And it's these novels that earned Raymond the reputation of the pioneer of British noir, a writer who anticipates the madness of later writers such as James Ellroy and David Peace. The factory novels were recently reissued by the publisher Serpent's Tower. Raymond's literary memoir, his autobiography entitled The Hidden Files, was published in 1992. Raymond died in 1994 in London, shortly after he returned to the city and took up residence in the Coach and Horses pub on Greek Street. Now, my analysis is based on these four books, The Four, The Quartet, and Raymond's autobiography. I suggested here that Raymond's novels explore the subjective possibilities of a historical moment, what Henri Lefebvre refers to as the critical phase of the implosion of the industrial city. In short, Lefebvre views the industrial city as being superseded by urban society, by widespread urbanisation, by what is referred to today commonly as planetary urbanisation. Urban society is not to be constructed on the ruins of the classical city. Indeed, in the West, the classical city, cities like London, exist in fragments, according to Lefebvre. So what happens is that existing urban centres implode, since they cannot contain everything. Their historic residential spaces are crumbling, in the process being replaced by offices, consumption spaces, and of course the bourgeoisie and the middle classes. So great urban centres of previous centuries, such as Paris or London, become effectively centres of power and wealth. They kind of cease to be real cities in a sense. They're just monuments to the emerging global economy. Now, Raymond's novels offer a rare subjective glimpse into the imploding city during this period. The structural changes that London underwent from the late 1970s onwards have been well observed. See, for example, Saskia Sassen's work. And there now exist many accounts of the urban explosion that followed, to the work of Neil Brenner, amongst others. But Raymond's rendition of central London during the early to mid-1980s as a morbid space provides a fascinating yet disturbing document of the process of implosion and the imaginaries that it inspires. And this whole idea, you know, if you read it in urban text of urban implosion, sounds relatively benign, but when you actually look at this through a novelist like Derek Raymond, it's far from benign. It captures what this implosion actually means and how it might be imagined. So the novels address, although they do not answer, the central question of Lefebvre's book, The Urban Revolution, which is how can we make the transition from the city, which maintains its image, which has a heart, a face, a soul, to urban society without a long period of disorientation. So the books, if you like, are set within this period of disorientation, this demise of the city, okay, and its displacement by more widespread, but centrifugal urban society. Okay, so I'm going to move on now to talk a little bit about the detective novel, okay, and how Derek Raymond conceives of the detective novel, or what he calls the black novel. Now, detective fiction has received a great deal of critical attention, arguably kind of disproportionately more than many other popular cultural forms. Critical theorists such as Benjamin, Krakauer, and Ernst Bloch were avid readers of the genre, and at various points in their work referred to detective fiction, either explicitly or in a more coded, metaphorical form. Fundamentally, Benjamin views the crime novel as a phantasmagoric description of the city that has its roots in the 19th century. For Benjamin, the literary genre of detective story snoops into the dark side of the city, depicting it as a place of anxiety and danger. The city becomes strange or unhomely. Every bed is hazardous, he writes. A lot of what Benjamin writes is about how, this Zimmerian sense that the city becomes a place where you become easily lost, and what the detective tries to do is, if you like, to recover human traces, the traces that we all leave by dwelling. So it's about kind of escaping from, the detective novel is about escaping from the anonymity of the crowd, if you like. Krakauer sees the detective basically as reconnecting a series of banal facts, okay, and he sees detective novels as largely uncritical, because the world is only apprehended through its phenomenal forms, yet the reason why these forms appear in the chaotic way they do is never revealed. So it's just about kind of banal facts, and the truth is banal in a detective case. Ernst Bloch argues that this takes a different tack, really, and argues that there are utopian murmurs and rumblings in detector neurons that can be seen in their attempts to measure the distance that we have yet to go to achieve happiness. He writes that the crime novel begins with something uncanny, an unrepresentable occurrence, and Bloch calls this the problem of the omitted beginning. The novel that follows is then concerned with exposing evidence of the past that can be productive for the future. The detective novel for Bloch is about exposing false illusions. It's deeply suspicious of draperies and facades. But more than anything, it's about the process of uncovering truth. It's about the process of uncovering truth rather than the bare fact of truth itself. Ernest Mandel takes a kind of a slightly more simplistic view and argues that detective fiction is primarily concerned with the bourgeois need to defend social order. But yeah, especially when one considers the noir fiction that emerged from the so-called hard-boiled authors in the US from the 1920s onwards, Chandler, Hammett, McCoy, and later Goodis, Himes, Elroy, detective novels may not be so easily reduced to bourgeois ideology, or is only concerned with the banality of life. As Duncan explains, noir doesn't always have pat solutions and attractive people, doesn't spoon-feed safe fantasies into drooling mouths. Noir drags you screaming and kicking through all sorts of hell before reaching an unsatisfactory ending. In noir, there is little redemption on offer. There are no happy endings. Noir detective fiction is also arguably beyond politics in the sense that it is thoroughly pessimistic regarding any governmental solution to crime via social policy or policing. Human depravity, noir tends to assert, is greater, deeper, more historical than any quick fix could hope to rectify. And this is just one sense in which writers and critics such as James Salas have argued that noir exists to unfold the lies society tells us and the lies we tell ourselves. Noir has also been used in, you know, within urban history previously in the work of Edward Dimmenberg or Matthew Farish. Now in Derek Raymond's autobiography, The Hidden Files, he explains what he means by the black novel. And he's referring explicitly here to his factory novels. The first thing to understand is that black literature exists because horror exists. The black novel is metaphysical and blurs boundaries between self and other, between beauty and sadness, offender, detective, victim and writer, between animate and inanimate objects. Raymond is attracted to alienated forms of consciousness because they mirror his own sense of desolation. For example, in discussing his writing of his bleakest factory novel, I Was Dora Suarez, Raymond explains how the book plunged him into evil and became the cause of my seeking to purge what was evil in myself. Moreover, Suarez was my atonement for 50 years' indifference to the miserable state of the world. It was a terrible journey through my own guilt and through the guilt of others. And he's kind of referring back here to his life within the London underworld and, you know, some of the things that he did or that he witnessed. And he was, you know, trying to explore this in a different way from the viewpoint of the victim. So the writer of the black novel, according to Raymond, becomes the room, the street, the situation. And fundamentally, the black novel describes men and women whom circumstances have pushed too far, people whom existence has bent and deformed. The black novel, for Raymond, is a serious endeavour. It's set against mass market crime novels. Its objective is not to escape, but to banish escapism, and he writes, to take people into the vile psychic weather outside their front doors. For Raymond, the black novel exists to show people what true despair is. Okay, it's about recognising the despair in others. And this is perhaps one of the reasons why Raymond's detective throughout the quartet of novels remains nameless. He's not important. He is simply everybody who has ever looked down over the edge into a void with the awareness that justice is absent. That's the problem of the black novel. The problem of the black novel is stark. Can a detective really establish credible contact with a dead victim in a shabby room? Raymond's words. Okay, so as I said, one of the reasons why these novels are so fascinating is that they portray London in the early to mid-1980s, this very interesting period. They capture what Joe Kerr calls, in writing about London, the general atmosphere of slow decline that pervaded the metropolis at this time. This period was characterised by a discourse of the crisis of the inner cities. This period is also critical to London's history because it represents the darkness before the dawn, with London's dawn being the Big Bang of 1986 that opened up the financial markets and did so much to allow the City of London to compete with Wall Street in becoming a command centre of the globalised economy, a process that Neil Brenner calls global city formation and state rescaling. Although the boom of the late 1980s, which extended with minor interruptions in the 1990s into the 2000s, was only a matter of years away when the novels were written, an alternative future for London other than continued despair and deterioration barely seems possible. Raymond's London is a shadow of its former social and architectural glories, yet of course it is this shadow's power to darken the whole city that fascinates Raymond. It's the negative possibilities of the historical moment, decay leading to death, which Raymond wishes to explore, at the expense, of course, of more optimistic scenarios or less ethnocentric situations. Raymond's London chimes with many academic sources of the time, taken mainly from urban studies, though his registry is vastly different, veiling his descriptions of urban decay with a distinctive noir aesthetic. And there's two examples here, which I won't talk about in great detail. Peter Hoyerthal's book, The Inner City in Context, which was published in 1981. The other end of the 1980s, Patrick Wright's A Journey Through Ruins, The Last Days of London. I was originally going to rip that off as my title, The Last Days of London, because this is the period that Raymond kind of immerses himself in. He's feeling that something is ending, that the city is dying, it's imploding in this way. Now, as Wright explains in his preface to the 2009 reprint of his book, as Patrick Wright explains, the London that was dying was the city of planning and the welfare state born of the post-war settlement. For Wright, this fall was partly the result of administrative incompetence and corruption, but yet it was also caused by the free market ideology of Margaret Thatcher's government. Now, of course, as I stated in my introduction, the significance of what was happening to London was actually far greater than many urban academics could grasp at the time. In terms of the depth of Raymond's writing, I feel that perhaps he conveys the social and psychic implications of the emptying or the implosion of the urban centre more acutely than many scholarly accounts. He captures the violence of the splitting open, the deterioration and the rotting that is present in Lefebvre's notion of implosion, which is here. So this is about what is happening to the urban core. Okay, but it's dying, but it seems to kind of maintain itself through some kind of monumentality. And Lefebvre talks quite prophetically about its reign seems to be ending unless it asserts itself again even more strongly as a centre of power, which is, of course, what did happen. Now, kind of, Lefebvre talks about how, you know, during this kind of period of implosion, explosion, there is a kind of a growing poverty of daily life as people, inhabitants of the city, have no choice to exist in a kind of increasingly homogenous space full of instructions and signals where exchange value dominates, economic rationalism, and qualitative difference between neighbourhoods, between residents, matters less and less. Such existence, for Lefebvre, is a recipe for contempt, mental and social misery. And these are the symptoms of an historical tendency towards the destruction of the city, as well as a tendency towards the intensification of the urban and the urban problematic. So this is the moment that the novels are situated. So I'm going to move on to an analysis of these novels now and how they inhabit this moment of urban history, but yet also kind of bend it out of shape a little. So this is one of a series of fairly common deep meditations, if you like, on London as a whole. And this is, in here, the unnamed detective is looking out of a window. He's interviewing somebody who turns out to be a contract killer from a tower block in Catford. And so I went over to the window and looked out. It was 4 PM, opposite 611 floor blocks stood about in the unimaginative attitudes of those who had conceived them on a piece of waste ground. Far away across the river, what was left of London these days tried to look cultured and inviting. It failed, anyway, with me. So we have here a sense of London's demise, this all-pervading gloom. There's a mixture of kind of nostalgia and despair here. There's more nostalgia in other excerpts that I won't kind of show you. Nostalgia for the 60s, I think, really. I mean, we see that Raymond, in a number of these kinds of quotes about London, he's kind of pro-urban in a sense, but he's anti-urbanist. He's anti-planning. Okay, he sees the dangers of segregation, of planning, of slum clearance that led to blight, which was still ongoing in the 1980s, the kind of site that we might find to be gentrified today. He's also anti-kind of conformity, anti this kind of growing society of bureaucratically controlled consumption, where, you know, things become very homogenous and difference is eroded. There's a similar quote here, which I won't kind of read to you, but this is a description of him driving out of London towards the west. We'll leave that for now. Now, of course, the novels are not only about the city, okay, but the metaphysical qualities of the black novel, as expressed by Raymond in The Hidden Files, allow us to consider the possibility of how the author becomes one with evil, becomes one with also with the wronged, with the lost, but also becomes one with the city itself. Raymond explains how in writing he becomes the room, the street, the situation. He inhabits these milieu. In reflecting upon writing the most disturbing of the four novels, I Was Dora's Prize, he explains, I became a part of everyone present in that miserable corner of hell, and they of me. I still can't get Dora out of my mind. I close my eyes and see her arms stretched out to the axe again in an attempt to reason with her killer through the desperate gasps of her breathing. I hear her last protracted cry for help that never comes. And he talks, you know, how writing this book and the voyage that he went on, you know, caused him an awful lot of damage personally. So if we look at these smaller spaces, the descriptions of these rooms and so on, you know, we see that Raymond is compelled to visit with obsessive purpose London's seedy and menacing pubs, acerbic offices, dismal road junctions and disused warehouses, as well as the dingy bedsits and rented rooms of the city. These sites are pitiful and full of sorrow, yet Raymond always renders them human places, even if the human quality is derived from sadness and tragedy. He inhabits, he becomes these places by expertly detailing the materiality of place to create a powerful structure of feeling. And here the narrator is, as always, the unnamed detective. And this is about, this is the room of a murdered guy, Charles Staniland. I will read this one. Staniland's room was one of the most putrid I ever saw. Rummily Place, this is a fictional place, was off the Lewisham end of the old Kent Road near the clock tower. The houses were three-storey tenements and filthy. I went up the stairs quickly, but trod on the side next to the wall to stop them creaking. They might just still be guests. I needn't have worried. Nothing followed me up the stairwell but a smell of garbage. The second door I came to, I sent in and shone the torch around. I was sure it was Staniland's room. I went to the window to open it and get some air, but it was nailed shut. So I stood in the middle of the bare linoleum floor and wondered what it must have been like, Staniland and Barbara, living there together when she was home. Barbara is one of two people who murdered Staniland. Home! There was the cookette in the corner by the window, just as he had described it. There too was the sink with the cracked mirror over which she had fixed her face nonchalantly after he had hit her with the shoe. There was the bedding on the floor where he had muttered his passion for her and where she had lain back flicking through the pages of Playgirl while he drunkenly tried to force her thighs apart. I don't believe in ghosts, but that room was thick with death, jostling me in the half dark. The dead man seemed to have grown after me to avenge him. The room was in an appalling state too. The weather was dry at the moment, otherwise I bet it rained in. I left, hoping the council would tear down the whole of Rummily Place one day, when they stopped screaming politics at each other. What's kind of interesting, it's a very, very depressing description, but one of the things that's interesting is that Raymond resolutely refuses or fails to acknowledge the gentrification and the regeneration that was in progress by the mid-1980s. He chooses to focus exclusively on the breaking apart aspects of urban implosion. And in this sense, Raymond's London, and just like all literary cities, is an artistic creation rather than a mirror image, although Raymond does maintain a fierce commitment to the real. For Raymond, it's the sorry details of demise, this kind of description, that matters. Whereas for Krakow, the facts are banal, Raymond's facticity is used to convey the deep alienation of life in London during this period. This is another example, another highly textured description conveying the squalor and sorrow that is so important to the author. It's important for him to convey or to explore where people died, how they died. It's a kind of matter of kind of restituting some kind of dignity. So here he is. I took in the shambles of the dark, cramped Victorian hall next. There was a pervading smell of urine everywhere. A pointed old woolen hat lay under a table where the phone stood with its cable ripped out. There was blood on the hat. It must have fallen off Carstairs' head when she hit the clock. Immediately beyond her body, a narrow corridor wandered at an angle to a kitchen door, kept open by a rug swollen with damp. All this back part of the flat, the hall, and the kitchen were bitterly cold. So again, this is another description of another very, very sad murder scene. We look to another metaphysical ambiguity in how these city spaces somehow are the perpetrator and also the victim, how they are the tormentor and the tormented. Now, Raymond knows London very well, like the back of his hand, as he says in his autobiography, having grown up in the city, having lived there for much of his life, and having spent 2 years as a minicab driver. So the books contain a mix of real and fictional spaces of London. The spaces revealed in the Factory series are summoned from this experience, from fraught early hours drives with strangers to unsettling and disgusting corners of the city. In The Hidden Files, he recalls a story where he drops a man off at a block of flats in North London and is told to wait. He witnesses a light go on in one of the flats, followed by female screaming coming from the same window. The screaming stops suddenly, and shortly after, the man returns to the taxi and asks to be taken on to Bethnal Green, and Raymond is paid £100 for his services. Now, through his unnamed detective, Raymond finds a way to enter these flats after the event and to reconfigure the private suffering forced on another, usually a female, and to seek some kind of justice for them, or at least recognition. In the novels, the spaces of the city are like the territories of the psyche, and Raymond is determined to explore the dark recesses of both. It's a game of dare. His aim is to pursue the evil that is a flagrant presence in the city, and to defeat malevolence through a central protagonist, the unnamed detective, whose tenderness for the lost is shown as the hope and the humanity that lies deep within us all. Yet Raymond, in his writing, fights everything, all of this, within himself. His writing exudes the urban consciousness of, in Lefebvre's words, this long period of disorientation. On the pages, Raymond's London, a representational space of fantasy and symbolism, yet as real as a block of flats, is the battleground, but also the stakes. But what do we mean when we say the city is at stake? Well, this is not simply the city of buildings or of architecture. Everywhere in the Factory Quartet, architecture, especially modern architecture, is shown to alienate, to separate good from evil, us from the other, the present from the past. No, Raymond is more concerned, I think, with the human city, an historic yet vulnerable city, a city of connections between people, between the living certainly, and segregation and urban planning are shown time and again to negate these bonds, but also between the living and the dead. Raymond wants to communicate with the lost of the city. Evoking kind of Benjamin's theory of the trace here. He writes that he deliberately peoples his books with wasted folk who don't understand why they have to go down without a cry. It's an impossible and exhausting task to communicate with the dead, but it's taken up in a number of ways throughout the Factory Quartet. For example, in He Died With His Eyes Open, the detective comes to understand and feel empathy for the murdered Charles Staniland through a series of cassettes found in his wardrobe at Romilly Place in Lewisham. The detective is able to listen to Staniland's voice then, and through learning about his depression, his alcoholism, his relationship with Barbara, a very damaged woman, and his victimisation at the hands of a bullying psychopath in a pub nearby in Lewisham, he's able to piece together the murder and to seek justice for Charles Staniland, the deceased. Also, when investigating the murder of Dora Suarez, the detective finds her diary amongst a few poignant personal belongings. The diary becomes a similar device whereby the dead live on and come to be understood and recognised by someone. Someone is, of course, our sympathetic nameless detective. This is the detective narrating again. While I was waiting for Stevenson, I walked away from the others to a tall window and looked out over London. Words of Dora's poured through me. I'm too fragile. I shall never find the courage to free myself. I'm blocked. I'm dying. I can't move. And again, there's this image of him taking in this view of London, but at the same time, the words of from Dora's diary are flowing through him. And there's kind of this metaphysical kind of blurring between Dora, between London, between the detective and the writer. There's a cover of the book, which is Derek Raymond is very, very big in France. He buys novels in supermarkets. But he publishes under the name Robin Cookie in France. So, he said he was taken more seriously in France. They take the kind of the black novel, the noir novel, much more seriously as an art form in France than they do here. So go back to the previous quote here. You know, Dora's despair becomes the detective's despair, and ultimately London's. But Raymond both loves and hates London. He's no different to most people in this. He's repelled by London, the carve-up that he constructs on the page. Yet it's only in the most sorrowful spaces of the city that he finds hope. It is in these crevices that hope must be found, between the beds, under the sofas, in the decrepit wardrobes and among the discarded tapes. Hope is always channeled through the compassion of the nameless detective, who is sardonic, cynical and cocky, but weeps uncontrollably when he's confronted with Dora Suarez's murder scene, and he's compelled to crouch down to kiss her battered head. It is as if for Raymond to draw hope from anywhere else would be superficial. Raymond wants, in Ernst Bloch's terms, for the darkness to be clarified. He needs to know just what there is and how scared we should be of it. The answer, of course, from the novels, which are very disturbing, is we should be very scared indeed. But this is catharsis, a cleansing moment for Raymond and for the city. It's a purge. Though shattered by the effort, Raymond can sense redemption for the city, even if he does not quite believe in it. As Raymond explains, I would never have dared let myself sink so deep into the ultimate horror of Suarez if I hadn't believed in a force willing to help me get out the other side. Suarez is an attempt to state that even though hope must always be subjunctive, paradise is perhaps not lost, that there may be a place for the lost after all, that it will be there after darkness. This is not redemption in a religious sense, more to do with restitution, dignity and end to suffering. Despite the bleak tone and horrific content of the quartet, this is where their peculiar warmth comes from. It's their anticipation, always, of something else. And of course, for London, something else definitely was on the horizon, as we know only too well. Now, how aware Raymond was of the kind of steady gentrification of London during the 1980s, we can't be sure. We can judge that for such a sharp observer of the city, it would not have passed him by completely. It's certain, however, that his factory novels and his autobiography ignore this aspect of urban implosion, that by which the centre becomes, according to Lefebvre's predictions, a resting place for wealth and power and a space for the practice of elite consumption. Maybe the gentrification that was occurring during this period was almost like a safety rope for Raymond to hold on to while he went about exploring the blight and the horror of the city. Maybe the tentative signs of upscaling that he observed in London, remitted from the novels, gave him the sense that this was as bad as things would get. The irony, of course, is that when accounts of urban decay such as Raymond's enter into the realm of production, they can contribute, in a meagre way, admittedly, to the process of gentrification, to driving down house prices, to providing areas with edgy, hip cachets that invite pioneers to sample the city's gritty authenticity. Moreover, Raymond's disgust at 1980s London, the novel's post-colonial melancholia and sometimes racialised narratives of decline can perhaps, like the film Taxi Driver did for Manhattan, according to Stanley Corkin, serve as an avatar of gentrification. The novels can unintentionally appear to will the pacifying effects of gentrification into existence. This would be unfortunate, and the comparison with Taxi Driver may be a little unfair, because Raymond is no authoritarian or vigilante. For him, the degradation of the city does not require an armed response. Raymond would instead opt for greater inhabitability, compassion, a stronger understanding between city residents, both dead and alive. Have I got a... No? Okay, I thought I had a conclusion slide there, but this is my conclusion. So this paper, through Raymond's novels, addresses a core concern within urban sociology, I think. There's major urban transformation, implosion, explosion, but it's still ongoing. It's about the demise, the death of the city and its historic urban centre and its displacement by explosive urbanisation. So Raymond's factory quartet surveys the implosion of the city during the early mid-1980s. It provides an intense investigation of urban decay and degenerating urban consciousness. In Ernst Bloch terms, the surplus of Raymond's work, and there's a great deal of this, helps grasp the conditions and tendencies of the period in which the author was writing. Simply, we cannot access this kind of urban imaginary of this particular period anywhere else. The facts, you know, unemployment figures, population figures, and so on, they don't kind of deliver this. Okay, they can't get at this. And Raymond doesn't construct any kind of urban pastoral. Raymond's London is fittingly a morbid space. And Raymond clearly goes beyond himself. He goes beyond reality because he emphasises some aspects over others. But in doing so, he more than hints at the human facets that the city lacks in this moment and will arguably go on lacking. Perhaps he anticipates what is to come. So in a way, the novels deserve to have a kind of greater impact, I think, really, because on our understanding of this historical moment. And other, perhaps other novels of this period or other cultural forms all can also help us understand this historic moment. Because subjective accounts of implosion explosion are kind of desperately lacking, especially subjective accounts of urban implosion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, questions? Comments? Any thoughts?